From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the president is doubling down on his statements that four U.S. congresswomen should, quote, go back to where they came from.
But if you're not happy in the U.S., if you're complaining all the time, very simply, you can leave. You can leave right now.
Also today, Ida O'Keefe, the lesser-known sister of an iconic American artist.
It was totally a shock that she existed.
Why haven't we ever heard of her?
Plus, a play based on the life of John Hancock's wife, Dolly, and the Hancock's enslaved servant, Cato.
These were real people with really complicated lives and relationships. And that's what we need to understand about history, is that it's not simple. And anytime we flatten out history, we don't really understand enough to ask the right questions today.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. More reaction today to President Trump's tweets over the weekend where he singled out four congresswomen, saying they should, quote, go back to where they came from. While he didn't name them, the four he seems to have targeted are all women of color, freshman congresswomen, and all American citizens. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker said the president's tweets were racist while speaking to reporters at an event earlier today.
I thought the president's tweets were shameful. They were racist, and they bring a tremendous amount of sort of disgrace to public policy and public life. And I condemn them all.
South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham defended President Trump on Fox.
We all know that AOC and this crowd are a bunch of communists. They hate Israel. They hate our own country.
Then this afternoon, the president himself strongly defended his remarks.
But if you're not happy in the U.S., if you're complaining all the time, very simply, you can leave. You can leave right now. Come back if you want. Don't come back. It's okay, too. But if you're not happy, you can leave.
Here with the latest on this story is WBUR's senior news correspondent, Kimberly Atkins. She's joining us from Washington. Kimberly, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Kimberly, for listeners who were, I don't know, maybe on vacation or on another planet over the last couple of days, can you summarize what the president tweeted that set off this latest firestorm?
Yes. So he inserted himself in a dispute that was bubbling up within the Democratic House caucus between these four members of Congress known as the Squad and Speaker Pelosi and Pelosi's supporters over some disagreements that they had, which started with a vote on the border funding bill. Well, the president jumped in and really tried to excoriate these members of Congress. He had already spoken verbally at the White House on Friday, saying it was terrible that Nancy Pelosi was being called racist because she disagreed with these four members of Congress. And he proceeded to tweet that these four members of Congress, all women of color, should go back to where they came from. Of course, they are all American citizens, all duly elected to Congress. And three of the four were born in the United States, and the other came here when she was a child. That would be Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota.
Yeah, actually, Kimberly, the president has said he wasn't naming names, but it's pretty clear. Can you name the four congresswomen?
Yes, it was four. In addition to Congresswoman Presley and Congresswoman Omar, it is also Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib from Michigan and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York State. It was the four of them that voted against this bill that led to Speaker Pelosi to make a comment about them in a New York Times piece, and the controversy sort of took off from there with Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez saying that it was disappointing that the speaker would attack four women of color. And that's when the president came in with his tweets.
So we heard just a little bit from the president's remarks earlier this afternoon. What is his overall response today to the charges that what he said is racist?
He double, triple, quadrupled down on his tweets. He did not back away from them at all. He did not say that it was racist. He said that the fact that Pelosi condemned the statement, saying that it showed, her tweet said that it showed that Make America Great Again, the president's motto, really means Make America White Again. He first called her statement racist and then went in and really, really criticized these four members of Congress strongly, really pointing, again, not naming names, but he pointed out to directly referring to Congresswoman Omar, saying that she hates Israel and hates Jews, saying that all four of these members of Congress hate America, and talking about Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez for keeping Amazon out of New York. It was very clear who he was talking about, and he did not exclude anyone from his criticism, particularly the one that he assailed them for saying that they hate America.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. What do you make of all this? Do you consider the president's comments directed at these congresswomen of color racist? Do you think he was making a valid point? Can you criticize your country and still love it? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. Kimberly, we're interested in our listeners' reactions, but first, what's the reaction like in Washington today?
Well, the president's tweets and his subsequent comments at the White House have been very strongly and nearly uniformly denounced by Democrats, who came out almost immediately, including the members of the Massachusetts delegation that condemned the statements as racist, as did the Republican governor, Governor Baker, from the clip that you played. There was a long silence from Republicans initially. It took them the better part of 24 hours to really put out any response to what the president said. But then since then, there have been some responses trickling in. One from Susan Collins put out a statement saying that she disagrees strongly with members, with many of the views of the far left members of the House Democratic Caucus, but then went on later and said that the president's tweets were, quote, over the line and he should take them down. Also, some condemnation from Congressman Mike Turner, a Republican from Ohio, who called the statement, who called the tweets racist, and also GOP Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, who called them racially offensive language.
So we're beginning to hear some Republicans weigh in here.
Kimberly, a few, but there's still some that we're still waiting on. We have not heard from, for example, Senator Mitt Romney or others who have been willing to criticize the president for his statements in the past.
Kimberly, we want you to stick with us through this whole conversation, but we also want to give some historical context to all of this. And here to help us do that is Michael Curry. He's the former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Michael, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me in.
Also with us on the line is David Shribman. He's the executive editor emeritus of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He's also a former Pulitzer Prize-winning politics correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thank you for joining us, David.
Thank you.
All right. Now, Michael and David, let me just begin with your reactions. Was this surprising or just reaffirming some of the rhetoric we've heard from Trump in the past? Michael, what do you think?
Well, I think it's a long history here if we're talking about candidate and then President Trump. So the berating, belittling and criticism of black women is not new. I remember an article Sophia Hall had written as a Republican about the tone and rhetoric of this party and the treatment of black men and women, and particularly women within the Republican Party. We talk about Abby Phillip, April Ryan, and Yamachi Alcindor, reporters who have been disrespected, even in press conferences and in hearings. It is not new. Congressman Maxine Waters, he talks about her intellect. He has a pattern and a practice of berating and belittling black women that I think speaks volumes. He is speaking code to his base, and I think we need to have a conversation on what that code is.
Let's hear from a listener. Jane in Georgetown, Massachusetts. What's on your mind?
What I want to say is that the president's comments are disgraceful. You, as president or as anyone in government, should never say that someone should come back, should go back to where they came from. They're Americans. We are all Americans, regardless of where we originally came from. And these women were born here. and they have a right to speak, and they have a right to disagree with him and with Nancy Pelosi.
Jane?
Yes.
No, go ahead.
His comments are disgraceful. We are a democracy. They are doing their job. They're doing what they were elected to do.
Thanks, Jane. That's really thanks for sharing your comments with us. And that gives me a chance to turn to you, David, and ask you, let's put some historical context here to what the president said. How unusual is it to hear such a comment from the president of the United States? Is there any time in the past when we might have heard comments like this from a U.S. president?
The only time I can possibly think of is the period from 1865 to 1869 when Andrew Johnson, who, as you know, was impeached, was president after the death of President Lincoln. No American president has used language remotely like this throughout history. Certainly, President Woodrow Wilson thought some of these things, and he did resegregate the federal bureaucracy. And from time to time, Presidents Truman and President Johnson used racially offensive epithets to speak of blacks, but they never did so in public. And in fact, President Truman desegregated the armed forces. President Johnson led the fight for the 1958 Civil Rights Bill and then signed the 1964 Civil Rights Bill and the 1965 Voting Rights Bill. So despite their private comments, President Trump said things that no president has said really since 1869.
Let's go to Chet from Warwick, Rhode Island. Chet, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, let's get right to the skinny. I mean, we're all saying this is very disturbing that he's saying these things, but he's been doing this since he started. What I don't understand is why the Republican hierarchy has not stood up right now, including the congressman, and said, you know, you're talking about one of my colleagues in Congress, and you're wrong, because this kind of behavior is not conducive of a democratic society. This is what started these dictators who ended up mostly getting killed or thrown out of office or put in jail or whatever. And this man is doing these things and people are letting him get away with it. And it's shameful every day that people call him president, because in my opinion, to be president, you have to be presidential. You have to show leadership. You have to be there for everyone. Right now, he's telling four women in Congress, if you're not happy with things, go back to your country. Well, hell, they're from the United States. Where are they going to go?
I don't get
why people are not sitting there and saying, look, enough is enough. And the people who voted for him, all of them should be ashamed of themselves who say they're Americans, because for some reason, everything that's being done right now with this guy has some kind of facade of the Russians and the way the Russians
want
him to
react. So, Chet, I don't want to lose the first part of your point, so I'm going to thank you for the call. And I want to bring in a quote again that we heard earlier. One of the things Chet talked about was the lack of Republicans speaking up in response to what the president said. Let's hear Governor Charlie Baker, a Republican.
I thought the president's tweets were shameful. They were racist, and they bring a tremendous amount of sort of disgrace to public policy and public life, and I condemn them all.
Michael Curry, your reactions.
Yeah, you know, again, it's disturbing. I always think of the term, and I've used it many times, the Faustian bargain. It's the deal with the devil. And on the Republican side, you have folks who've decided that he is going to deliver certain policy wins for them that is worth having him be offensive to other Americans. And they've decided to sit quietly and let him do that, that the policies he's delivering delivers something for them, whether it's tax policy, whether it's repealing Roe v. Wade, Title 10, public charge, go down the list. They should be ashamed of themselves. This is, as the caller said, un-American. The other thing is, I say to the rest of us who are watching and frustrated by this, don't get weathered. Weathered meaning don't get used to it and get numb to it. This should awaken all of us to stand up and challenge this administration and really make a statement that we won't tolerate attacking other Americans for their differences of opinion and their right to represent us in Congress as women of color. We should all be offended no matter what a party we're with.
Let's take another call. Paul from Bryantville, tell us what's on your mind.
Yes, I was just a bit confused as to when they keep saying a woman of color,
I didn't think that AOC was a woman of color. They're just using a broad term to just label everybody a person of color nowadays.
So let's get some clarification for that, Paul. Thanks. Kimberly Atkins, can you please clarify the racial identity of the four women in question?
Yeah, sure. So Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is from New York. She was born in New York, and her family is of Puerto Rican descent. A reminder to everyone that Puerto Rico is also a part of the United States, but she is a woman of color. She is Latina. Then you have, of course, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who is African American. You have Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who is from Somalia. Her family immigrated here when she was a child. And then you have Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, who is of Palestinian descent.
Thank you for that. What happens if somebody's arguing instead that this is a matter of patriotism? It's not about race. One of the people arguing that is Jeff Diehl, who ran against Elizabeth Warren for her Senate seat. He says he doesn't see the president's comments as racist, but as about patriotism.
They seem to have a real problem with America as it currently is constituted or being managed. And, you know, again, one of them, you know, did immigrate here. And I think the point is, look, if you think another country is so great, perhaps you want to go back to that country if America is not that great. So I don't find it to be the racism that other people are trying to, you know, find in it. What I see is a frustration with people that don't seem to believe that America is a good place or something that these women, you know, want to constructively work with him to make better.
David Shribman, from a historical perspective, what's your reaction to that?
Well, historically, many rebels, people who have objected to the way American life was being conducted, have been celebrated later as great patriots. And I would use many, many examples, but one of them is Martin Luther King, who certainly objected to the way American life was constituted, and now he has a federal holiday. There are many other people who have expressed dissent and who are beloved in history. Expressing dissent is one of the great traditions in American life. After all of the founding fathers or the revolutionaries themselves expressed dissent, and we consider them great patriots. Dissent and patriotism are not mutually exclusive.
Michael Curry, that reminds me of some of Dr. Martin Luther King's writings on righteous love and the idea that righteous anger comes from a place of loving the other person and therefore wanting them to do better. What is your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, the best example of American patriotism is to challenge how we do things, to challenge our ideals, to make us step up to the potential of this country. I think anyone who does not know that does not know American history. That is so embedded in what American history is, as was just said. Some of the people we revere today were people who challenged them, just like these four young ladies are doing. They don't always have to be right, but when they are right, and I think history will bear that out, they're challenging us to treat our immigrant communities, our immigrants better. They're challenging us to do the right things about environmental justice. And unfortunately, this president is disrespectful to them in a way that is racist. And I think one other thing I'd say to that, we got to get to a common definition of what racism is, because it's insulting when folks can say something's not racist, but they don't understand that when you say to any person, particularly a person of color, an African American, go back to the country you came from, that's generations of being told to go back to Africa because we challenged them on civil rights, on voting rights. Go back to Africa if you don't like this country. And for an elected official or a candidate for office or any American not to know that is insulting.
Kimberly Atkins, do you hear a conversation happening in Washington right now about what is the definition of racism and how do we call it out today?
I think there has been a struggle, particularly on the Republican side, to try to say what is and what is not racist. But I think the point has to be clear that particularly for people of color who have been on the receiving end of comments like this, and I include myself in that, the definition is pretty clear. And so at best, it seems that the president is using a dog whistle. It often sounds more like a bull. Horn. And I think certainly on the Democratic side, the notion that those tweets and other comments from this president are racist without question.
So the lines are full, so let's take some calls. Alex from Lowell, tell us what's on your mind.
Yes, hello. I'm just curious, was the president responding to a vicious attack by Representative Omar, or did he just come out of the blue and state this? I wish your station would play the whole context of what he said. It doesn't seem to be racist at all. I think it's very insulting to people to think the president would be racist when you're not playing the whole context of what he said. He was telling them to that one person, one representative who was vicious to him, to go back to the country she came from and try to fix that country before he started insulting and denigrating America. That's what the president was saying.
Alex, thanks for that. And I'm going to take a couple more calls, but then we will give a little bit more context there. Jake from Burlington, tell us what's on your mind.
I just find it interesting, and thanks for having me on air. I appreciate it. I find it interesting that originally this wasn't about race, and it wasn't until AOC's tweet that I believe that President Trump saw an opportunity to insert himself into the dialogue in a way that's going to fire up his base.
Thanks for that, Jake. We'll take one more. Mariama from East Boston, tell us your thoughts.
We already know that Trump is racist. Everybody know that. It's a given. His campaign has been on the back of just attacking minorities and people of color. So I just find it that it wasn't a coincidence, and it was super interesting that he tweeted this out on the day that he was going to do the immigration raids were going to start. And I think in many ways, I feel like this was done to kind of distract the media from what was about to happen. And he succeeded at it, because here we are talking about it and not reporting too much on what happened over the weekend or if anything happen in other areas.
Thank you, Mariama. Listeners, we want to keep hearing from you. You are a part of this conversation. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. There was so much in that set of listener calls. Let me just start with you, Kimberly Atkins, and maybe you can give a little bit more history about the president's tension with Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who is from Somalia and a naturalized citizen. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, so generally, going back a little bit, Congresswoman Omar has been critical of this president and his policies. She has also been on the receiving end of a great deal of criticism from this president and other Republicans for comments that she made that they have said were anti-Semitic or expressed antipathy toward Israel or Jewish people. She has said that that was not the case. And so that feud goes back a little while. This immediate controversy, the president inserted himself after, as I said, comments that were made by Speaker Pelosi in a New York Times piece that Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez took issue with and said, it wasn't a tweet, she said to a reporter that she was disappointed that the speaker was going after women of color. It was after that that the president, first in comments he made at the White House, and then in this tweet, went after these four members of Congress and saying, I mean, the tweet begins, progressive Democratic Congresswomen who originally came from countries whose governments are complete and total catastrophe. The tweet goes on. It's three tweets long, but essentially says they should, quote, go back and help fix the totally broken and crime infested places where they came. In terms of whether or not this is racist, as we've discussed, go back to insert place there is a racist trope that is as old as the founding of this nation in terms of its role as in the racism that has been unfortunately a part of our country's history. And that is the way that it was taken, certainly by the people who it was directed to and by Democrats.
So, David Shribman, I want to build immediately on what Kimberly just said. What is the sort of the nativist context in which we've had a dialogue around go back to where you came from in American history?
Well, the nativist impulse in American history goes back to the revolutionary days, of course. But generally speaking, in the 19th century, there was a lot of nativism. There was the Know Nothing Party, which was a nativist party in the middle of the century. And Irish Americans, particularly in Boston and New York, were subjected to that. And so has every wave of immigrants. And it is a sad part of joining this country. But generally speaking, it's come and gone, and it'll be good if it were gone soon.
Thanks for that. Michael Curry, I want to return to you in just a second to get some more reaction on the history here, but I want to throw in a longer version of what Lindsey Graham had to say. Let's listen to that real quick.
We all know that AOC and this crowd are a bunch of communists. They hate Israel. They hate our own country. They're calling the guards along our border, the Border Patrol agents, concentration camp guards. They accuse people who support Israel of doing it for the Benjamins. They're anti-Semitic. They're anti-America. Don't get down. Aim higher. We don't need to know anything about them personally. Talk about their policies.
Senator.
Great. So, Michael Curry, we've talked about a lot since the last time you spoke. You always have interesting things to say. Where do you want to go?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. One is your caller who said it's not racist, and I'm really imploring on your caller to raise his consciousness of what racism is. I would suggest he go back and watch the 1915 film Birth of a Nation. I'd suggest he go back and read some literature that talks about what racism is so that then we can have a rational conversation about whether something is racist or not. Ultimately, what we find here is, and another thing I challenge is that the nativism has come and gone. We know that the Irish, Italian, American face those signs, Irish need not apply. But the difference between that and race is that many of those immigrant communities matriculated into the mainstream of Boston society or American society, while African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, and many others were still being treated that way and told to go back to their countries of origins. That never stopped. And in fact, some of those other communities, those other immigrant communities, then perpetuated the same thing that they experienced here as well. So I think if we want to have a rational conversation about race and the differences, nativism, if you want to use that term, has never ceased for people who are of certain races.
David, did you want to throw in some more there?
Yes, I wanted to add that he's quite right. And to add one other thing is the Birth of a Nation, which he... which he referenced, was actually screened in the White House.
Yes, Woodrow Wilson.
By Woodrow Wilson, who was a racist president, and whose reputation has been besmirched and in more recent years because we are much more conscious of this sort of thing. And Woodrow Wilson, who was a hero to many, including Franklin Roosevelt, now is a hero to almost no one.
So let's take a couple more calls here. We've got Keith from Lincoln, Rhode Island. Keith, tell us your thoughts.
Yeah, hi. So the thing that's been going through my head listening to this in the news and hearing everybody's reactions to it is that everybody seems, well, people seem to be focused on, you know, whether this go back to where you came from sentiment is racist and xenophobic, and it is. I think it's horrible, it's reprehensible, but I guess I would like to... I would have liked our congresswomen and everyone to not take the debate so much. And the answer that seems to be rattling around in my head that they should maybe respond with is that they're there to make a change here, right? It doesn't matter where they came from, what country they came from, right? They were elected, and they're trying to make a difference here, and... So the logical response would be, you know, I'm not going to run away if I don't like it. I'm not going to go back somewhere else.
Keith, I'm sorry to interrupt. You're making an important point there. I want to hear from one more caller while we have time. So I'm going to move now to Joe from Reading. Joe, also tell us what's on your mind. Joe, are you there? Okay, I think we might have lost Joe from Reading, and that's fine. There's a lot to think about here. I want to pull one more piece of sound for us to listen to, because this is also happening in the context of the president being aware that he is in a re-election. So we heard hints of that during his speech this afternoon. Let's listen.
And the Democrats in this case, if they want to gear their wagons around these four people, I think they're going to have a very tough election, because I don't think the people of the United States will stand for it.
Okay, so Michael Curry, on the one hand, hey, people won't stand for this kind of criticism. On the other hand, like our caller just said, these were women who were elected by their constituents specifically to make change. Isn't at some level this a healthy tension between criticism and change? And isn't this part of how we struggle through change?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, we want a system where you have divergent voices, where you have young perspectives. And essentially, they represent sort of the next generation of perspective on how we see our relationship with Israel. And I've talked to Israeli leaders or Jewish leaders here around how they view these women. They don't have the same perspective, many of them, that Donald Trump does or that some in the Republican Party do. They want a healthy conversation about our foreign policy, our domestic policy, and these women are bringing it. Whether you're uncomfortable with it or not, I mean, history is replete with examples when people are uncomfortable with new perspectives or really honest perspectives, right? Things that people have been thinking but just didn't say. And we're finally at a point. I know Ayanna Pressley very well. We knew that when we sent her down to Congress, she was about to set it on fire because she's an authentic person and she knows history. She's conscious. And we expect her to do just that. I think the callers that have called in, I would encourage you get to know her. Actually listen to what she says, because many of what you'll find out is an informed opinion. And I find that to be the same with the other women as well.
And can I make a point on that?
Yes, actually, Kimberly, I was just about to turn to you. Please go ahead. WBUR correspondent Kimberly Atkins.
And yes, so the caller was talking about how members of Congress will react. But when it comes to Congresswoman Pressley, she has her response. She initially called the president's tweets racist. She says she's retweeted it saying this is what racism looks like. But beyond that, in her appearances and in her statement, she says that she has moved on and she is focused on the business of Massachusetts 7th District. She talks about things like gun violence that's happening in the district. She talks about things like health care. She very much puts the focus back on the policy that she wants to focus on. She, by and large, has not engaged in some extended dispute with the president on this issue. She's taken a very specific approach of focusing on the policy.
So, David Shribman, yes, I'd like to give you, I think, the last word here. So, share your thoughts.
I want to add that this is, the United States is not Canada, which took 150 years, really, to find its rebellion. The United States was forged in revolution and in rebellion. Rebellion is a tradition in this country. It's revered. It's how we make change. We have made change about race, about ethnicity. We've made change about disability and sexual orientation through rebellion. It's something that we revere, something that we treasure, and it's how we make ourselves a more perfect union. And I think to criticize people for having views that are outside the mainstream is really, in some ways, to deny the Americanness of what they're doing.
That is David Shribman, executive editor emeritus of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and former Pulitzer Prize-winning politics correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thanks for joining us, David.
Thank you.
Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And Kimberly Atkins, WBUR senior news correspondent. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Boston.
Always good to talk to you.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. When you hear the name O'Keefe, who pops into your mind? If you said Georgia, you're not alone. Her pastel-colored flowers and desert landscapes are iconic. But there was more than one driven artist in the O'Keefe family. WBUR's Andrea Shea reports on the sleuthing it took to build an exhibition around a lesser-known O'Keefe, Ida, that just opened at the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, Massachusetts.
Clark visitors Dick Diamond and his wife are huge fans of Georgia O'Keefe.
I mean, we went through all the O'Keefe stuff, her home and so on, but I don't remember reading about her sister there.
Marvin Cooper recalls reading something somewhere about Ida O'Keefe.
It was totally a shock that she existed.
Why haven't we ever heard of her?
That's what curator Sue Canterbury asked back in 2013 when she looked across a room in an art collector's house at a blue, white, gray, and black geometric painting of a Cape Cod lighthouse.
I was puzzled by it. I was trying to figure out who it was by. I just had to know. When the owner told me, oh, that's Ida O'Keefe, George O'Keefe's younger sister, I was, what?
Intrigued by Ida, the curator began a quest to uncover the story of a forgotten artist. Canterbury compares it to resurrecting the dead. The art and information she's amassed debuted last year at the Dallas Museum of Art, where Canterbury works. Now the show, Ida O'Keefe, Escaping Georgia's Shadow, is at the Clark. It begins in the 1920s with snapshots taken by pioneering photographer Alfred Stieglitz. Ida and Georgia spent time together at his Lake George retreat. In one picture, both sisters smile happily.
That's not the usually imperious Georgia that one recalls, you know, cool and calm and severe looking.
Stieglitz would marry Georgia in a few months, but Canterbury says he flirted relentlessly with Ida in the fall of 1924, which Georgia laughed off. Then the curator points to a photo with a very different vibe.
Georgia staring straight down the barrel of Stieglitz's lens, very hard looking, and Ida next to her is just, you know, looking to the side and looks a little bit unsure. And it almost just seems like the perfect symbol of what their relationship would become in a way.
Growing up, Ida and Georgia took art lessons with the same teachers. Georgia studied painting with Charles Martin at Columbia. Years later, Ida did too. But in 1933, when Ida wanted to exhibit in New York, Georgia told her she better not.
Ida refused to stop exhibiting, and even though they've been close, they became absolutely estranged after that.
Canterbury thinks Georgia felt her sister was riding on her coattails. Some people thought the same about Georgia and her influential husband, Stieglitz.
He helped guide her, and then he introduced her to the right critics and the collectors, helped increase the value of her art, develop her brand into becoming the mother of American modernism.
Canterbury plowed through biographies about Georgia, searching for leads about Ida. Eventually, she asked the public for help through crowdsourcing. People came forward with letters, artwork, and Ida's professional scrapbook. It's stuffed with reviews of her art and articles about her taking yet another faculty teaching job. Canterbury reads a headline from San Antonio, where Ida taught from 1938 to 39.
It says, "Artist sister joins Lady of Lake faculty." Everywhere she went, she was always introduced through the aura of her sister, who was never having this chance to stand on her own.
Sometimes Ida dropped the name O'Keefe for exhibitions. She also distinguished herself through her art, experimenting with symmetry, abstract forms, and monotypes, which Canterbury says helped her make money during the Depression. Unlike her sister, Ida never married. She also never had a dealer.
Women could not get that unless you were under the wing of a man, like Stieglitz, for instance. And so Georgia's situation is one that is so exceptional. It was a situation that 99.99% of the other women artists didn't get.
This was not lost on Georgia's sister.
I'd at one point say, well, I'd be famous too if I'd had a Stieglitz.
The O'Keefe sisters never reconciled before Ida died in 1961. Canterbury hopes people who visit the exhibition will walk away thinking about all the unsung women artists out there and about how many are ripe for rediscovery.
That report from WBUR's Andrea Shea. Ida O'Keefe, Escaping Georgia's Shadow, is on view at the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown through October 6th. You can see Ida's artwork in the artery section of WBUR.org. Stay with us. Coming up, an original play, Cato and Dolly, gives us a look inside the Hancock household through the eyes of those who lived there. We'll talk with the playwright. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Former Massachusetts Governor John Hancock was not one to shy away from the spotlight. Every school child knows Hancock presided over the Second Continental Congress, and his signature takes up the most space on the Declaration of Independence. But the play Cato and Dolly, which has returned to the old statehouse this summer, turns the attention away from Hancock and focuses instead on the lives of the people that surrounded and supported him. The play is about his wife, Dolly Hancock, and Cato, an enslaved man in the Hancock household. And the inspiration for the play was the actual front door of the Hancock house, which was preserved after the Hancock mansion was torn down in 1863. Patrick Gaybridge is the writer behind the work and is also the producing artistic director of Plays in Place, a theater company focused on site-specific productions. Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna spoke with Gaybridge last summer to find out who exactly Cato and Dolly were.
So Cato Hancock was a man who was enslaved in the John Hancock household. When they came to me and said, you know, we want to write a play that's centered around this door from the Hancock household, trying to figure out who are the people that lived in that household, and we're trying to tell some forgotten stories. So Cato Hancock, we don't know a lot about him. It's hard to get facts and information about people whose voices aren't recorded. But we knew enough about him to know where he was married. We know where his children were baptized. And we think we know where he died. And he's also referenced in a number of letters from John Hancock. So we kind of know some times when he's in the household. And he's also referenced in the wills of Thomas and Lydia Hancock, who were John Hancock's aunt and uncle.
So you did a little archival dig on Cato.
We did a big archival dig on Cato. And it was a lot of combing through the record to kind of figure out, well, who are the people that were there that we can know enough about to sketch out a story that who we haven't heard about a lot.
And did we know more about Dolly?
We know a little bit more about Dolly, which is odd because that we don't know more of her because she was kind of the first lady of Massachusetts. John Hancock was the first governor of Massachusetts. And she was also active when John Hancock was presiding over the Continental Congress. But her writings didn't tend to survive. He wrote to her a lot of times telling her, how come you never write to me? He was kind of a needy guy, but also a very popular politician. What was interesting was we started finding out things that we didn't know or that kind of tended to get overlooked in the historical record about her. So it is interesting that she was there helping him out socially during the Continental Congress. So while they're drafting the Declaration of Independence, she's there serving as social hostess and everything while she's also pregnant.
Wow. So she's almost directly involved with his work there.
She was definitely directly involved with his work. There was not a lot of money in the Continental Congress at that time. So their wives would help them. Like she would stay up late into the night helping him sign papers. There were a lot of papers to sign during the Continental Congress. So she was very involved and also ran the household, and it was a very busy household, very social household. So she's very busy with that.
And you said, again, while pregnant. I mean,
right.
Is that typical of the time? I mean, were their lives typical of women and enslaved people at the time?
I think what's interesting is that when you see history books written, as they traditionally have been, by white men, the details of people's lives sometimes tend to get overlooked. And so women's roles are overlooked, but also kind of the elements of their lives. So when they're pregnant, or in her case, she loses two children during the war years, essentially, and slightly after the war years. And so trying to understand, you know, what did that mean? And she loses two children and two husbands in the course of her lives. And so what does that mean? What does it mean to be surviving in that kind of household?
And so in thinking about these ideas, did you take a lot of artistic licenses in creating this story?
I had to take some for sure because, again, their voices are not well recorded. So we don't have writings by them. We don't have a lot of letters by them. But so I'm trying to understand how they relate to each other. And both could have been in the household for a long time. We know Cato was in the household from when he was a boy until he was definitely in his 30s, when he was freed at age 30 by Thomas Hancock's will. We don't know exactly when that happened, but we can kind of figure it out. And then we know he stays beyond that, which is kind of interesting. So he's a slave in the household, and then he remains working there as a servant.
Right, he becomes their servant, and then at one point he speaks of missing working and living in their home. And I guess I'm curious about that sort of more positive portrayal of this relationship. I mean, he was enslaved by the Hancocks. Is this true to history?
We don't know exactly how he felt about it, but what we do know is that he had limited options in North America at that time. Because a lot of times we think about slavery as kind of the antebellum period and the Southern slavery model of plantation slavery and house slaves. But New England slavery was very different. And also in this period, so slavery ends in Massachusetts in the early 1780s. But so in this period, when he's a slave in the 1760s and 1770s, there's nowhere for him to go when he's freed, particularly. It's not like he can't just kind of go. There's no place that doesn't have slavery in North America. So it's not like, you know, he's going to go north and become free. Mm-hmm. So instead, he has to think about how he's going to align himself with people who can protect him. And he happens to be working for the richest man in Boston in the most powerful household. So he makes, a calculated decision. But he is also part of that household, and I think an integral part of that household.
Huh. I want to ask you about your process of telling this story. You're telling this story of a woman and a person of color who's enslaved. What was that process like for you?
I definitely understand that it's a challenge for me. And I write about race a lot in my work. I come from a mixed race family. So issues of race are really important for me to explore, to kind of understand my own family. But I think we definitely thought about it a lot, the whole team, and trying to make sure it's just so hard, because you don't want to underplay the fact that he was a slave and slavery is terrible. At the same time, he makes a decision to stay. So try to understand why that is and try to understand how households worked in that time period. And it was different from how they work now. So people were very vertically integrated, trying to understand who protects you and who do you protect. Those situations of power were really important.
Right.
And so trying to get that and trying to constantly challenge my lens and think about, and, you know, working with the actors and director to bring other points of view too.
I also want to ask you about this idea of looking back at history. There are conversations throughout the city and the country on renaming things, and just around the corner from the old state house is Faneuil Hall, which some activists have called upon the city to rename because its namesake, Peter Faneuil, made money off of slavery and he was a slave owner himself. How do you think this play fits into the reexamination of history and the conversations that we're having right now as a city?
I think the key thing about useful elements of a play like this is it shows the complexity of the questions that we're asking and the complexity of lives at that time period. These are not easy things to figure out. And these were real human beings who had to make really, really hard choices in the situations that they were in. And again, this isn't a play about John Hancock. He figures in, but we made a very conscious decision to have a play with only two actors, a man and a woman. So those two people play everything. So John Hancock is often played by a woman. The actor who plays Cato, he plays like five or six different people. So we're moving across race and gender in the roles that we're playing. And that also helps change and shift the conversation a little bit to make sure we're thinking about, how do we approach these as people? How can we shift our lenses?
And in terms of the actual staging of this, you mentioned it was in front of this door.
Right.
And you're putting this on at the old State House, which we know is the oldest public building in Boston. And, you know, because when the Hancock Mansion was torn down, there was this big public outcry that led to a focus on preserving other pre-Revolutionary War buildings in the city. So as someone who uses spaces of historical or cultural significance for your inspiration, what do you think about when you're approaching the telling of a story like this and keeping the physical spaces in mind?
So I worked in this building the last 2 years on a play called Blood on the Snow that was really popular, that took place in the old council chamber.
It's about the Boston Massacre.
About the Boston Massacre, in the room where this had happened. So that was a strictly realistic play. This play because we're not in the room where these things happened, would necessitated a non-realistic approach. We knew we had the door there, but we couldn't touch the door. We couldn't go through the door because it's a 300-year-old historic door. So instead, we had to use it as a reference point, as a metaphor to understand how we shape things. So that's why the structure of this play is so different. So what is the door? How do we use it?
Well, so finally, I wanted to ask you about that. What do you hope people who come and see this 24-minute play, as you call it, what do you hope they take away from it?
I think someone was facilitating a discussion for us, and she said, you know, before I saw this play, if I'd walked into this room, I would have said, oh, nice door, and then walked away. And instead, now when they walk in, they think, oh, this door has seen a lot of things, and where these were real people with really complicated lives and relationships. And that's what we need to understand about history, is that it's not simple. And anytime we flatten out history, we don't really understand enough to ask the right questions today. So if we can answer the right questions about the past, we can understand the present much better.
That's Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna speaking last summer with Patrick Gaybridge, the writer of the play Cato and Dolly. He's also the producing artistic director of Plays in Place, a theater company focused on site-specific productions. Cato and Dolly runs through August 11th at the Old State House. You can find more information at radioboston.org. Listeners, the four congresswomen named by President Trump's tweets, including our representative in Boston, Ayanna Pressley, are going to respond at 5 o'clock today. We'll have more coming up on WBUR's All Things Considered. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.